Good morning, everyone. It's a bit of a strange. I have people at different distances and views, so I'm wearing my glasses so I can see you on the screen, and that changes how I see everyone. But that's okay. This is our story. This is our wildflower story. Which I love. I love the wildflowers and how we practice and making use of whatever we have to the best of our ability, efficient, organic, wild wildflowers. They don't need anyone to plant them in a specific place with a specific pot or in some wonderful arrangement. Nothing extra. They grow wherever they are, and make use of the sun and the earth and the rain, circumstance in which they find themselves, which is our story, which is the story of all of us, of the universe. But sometimes we lose sight of that. I recently heard a Tibetan teacher who said that even when we sometimes are involved with a true spiritual path, we tend to focus on the created, the contrived conditions and forms and practices, rather than being just here right now with what is. That we must, as we say, you know, we mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon. And by not having a fixed architecture, as we say, or even having very little material things, we borrowed our cushions from Donna. Claudia invited us into her home. You are all in your homes, inviting us into your homes. Claudia had a bell, I had clappers. Here we all brought something that we will share for lunch. It's like the grass hut that we've been studying in the study group. It's just a grass hut, and there's nothing of value here, which means everything is of value, and the grass hut protects us. It gives us a space in which to do our practice, and yet it's impermanent. This space that we're in Claudia's, this building used to be something else. I think it was a factory, or yeah, it used to be a factory. And then, like a sawmill or wood
thing? Wood.
Yeah. So a factory, a place where they worked with wood. And then even this space, that when Claudia came here, it was just one space, and now it's been made into different spaces. I read recently in the local Maltai newspaper that the restaurant downstairs from here, which used to be called Chez Carla, you know, which was known in Maltai, I think it was a Portuguese restaurant even, yeah. Well, it's now been taken over by the people who used to run the restaurant and the cinema. Did you know this?
Yeah.
Lefebvre. Yeah.
I know.
And now have their restaurant here. So it's just it's a space that is being lived, that has been given life. It's impermanent. wherever we go is, like I say, you know, the ground of awakening. So wherever you are is it, is where you need to be. I went to see an exhibition recently of Nicolas de Staël, a painter who I really, really like, in Paris. Has anyone else seen the exhibit?
I
No?
want to
Yeah.
see.
I had this phrase that he said that was one of the phrases on the wall. It's just been occupying my mind for 2 weeks now. Translated in English, it's the pictorial space is a wall. But all the birds in the world fly freely there, which is so much like our practice. So of course we have this computer screen. He's a painter, so he has this space that he paints on. He has paints that he uses. Wonderful photograph of Claudia's on the wall, you know. So there's this set limited space, and yet all the birds in the world fly freely there. It's almost like you could put a frame, an empty frame, and the birds would be flying in and out. We live in this limited space, this pictorial wall, right? That's the world we live in, is the limited world. And yet all the birds in the world fly freely there. Now I think Nicolas de Staël, he pushed this as far as he could go, and he ended up jumping out the window onto the cliffs. But he they don't say this in this exhibit, but I've seen this in other of his exhibits, that he wanted to, his ambition was to like reduce as much as possible the lines, the color, to get to the most efficient pictorial space or something like that. To get to the grass hut of painting, maybe, or something like that. And at some point, I think he became despairing about not being able to do that, or he didn't know how to do it, or something. Gave up, or whatever. I don't know exactly what happened to him, but I mean, I do know how his life ended, but I don't know how he went with it to that space. But this is very inspiring, I feel, that can we, or another thing that has, been my theme lately is traveling light. So can we travel so light that we really have nothing? We have only what we need. What is it that we need? We have to discover this, right? Each of us has our own what we need. In our Sangha, what we need is what we have, really. And that's true freedom, is wanting what you have. Not something else. The cushions we borrowed are good enough. The little altar is absolutely perfect. The zendo we've created, and the zendo you've created in your homes, absolutely perfect. Walking around in the Marais yesterday, which I used to live in that neighborhood like 30 years ago. Almost, 30 years ago. And it's changed dramatically. And when I go there, I'm kind of sick to my stomach how much it's different than what it used to be. But then I catch myself and I say, well, why should it be like what it was before? This is what it is now. And as my husband said, when we were walking, he said, oh, it's kind of like a shopping mall. And it is, to a certain extent, certain parts of it. And it was not like that when I lived there. And in one of the windows of a shop, like probably like facial cream or something like that, I don't know, it said, don't look for perfection, look for yourself. Wow. In the middle of this, like, you know, shopping mall marais, with all, you know, like all of these fashionistas and, you know, Instagram influencers and lots of American tourists and, in all of these, like, you know, sweet boutiques and all these high-end fashion stores and everything. And in this window it says, don't look for perfection, look for yourself. Of course, this was a marketing slogan. But who cares? Someone is, oh, okay. Christine's turning off her camera, I guess, to keep, okay. But who cares if it's a marketing slogan? The meaning of that is really beautiful, you know? And our entire practice of Wildflower, that could be our slogan, you know? Don't look for perfection, look for yourself. You know, there's these beautiful, these sanghas that have these amazing zendos and these people like dressed in amazing costumes and these rituals that are done to absolute perfection. And I'm not talking about Dana. Let's not be confused, because they don't fit that category. You know, and they just all this stuff that's looks so perfect and beautiful and amazing. And then, you know, the teacher will have this amazingly constructed written talk that they will read, and there will be hundreds of people online or something. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The danger is that we come to believe that that's what it's about. Don't look for perfection, look for yourself. The pictorial space is a wall. Okay, so there's that picture on the wall. There's that picture of these people in their perfect robes doing, you know, wonderful kin hin and amazing calligraphies on the wall. And it's contrived. It's like, you know, Mingyur's father said to him, it's fake. It's fake. Or another artist who I've become interested in lately, Marcel Duchamp, who said, art is the gap. It's not what we see. And we know Duchamp became famous for what he called ready-made. You can make art out of anything. And that's inspiring, you know? Our practice is everything. If you can make it out of anything, then it means it's everything. Recently, I've been working with someone on one of our koans, which is about Shakyamuni's awakening. So it's when he, you know, awakens and he said, I and all sentient beings are simultaneously awakened, or something. I and all sentient beings throughout space and time are simultaneously awakened. And this is one of the, you know, foundation myths of our lineage, of all of Buddhism. It's, you know, considered this key moment where after he's tried everything, this guy, after like Barbie, he left Barbie Land, he left, you know, his palace, he left, he saw the imperfection, you know, he didn't understand why people were getting old and sick and dying, and suddenly everything was not what he thought it was, and he goes out and tries all these different ways to understand it, nothing works. So then he sits down by himself under a tree, and after a certain amount of time, has this moment of awakening that this phrase has gone down through the ages, that he says when he sees the morning star. This is the foundation myth, right? The creation myth. And there's another version of that, which Genroshi put on this back of this Rakusu, which she gave me when I started teaching. This is my purple Rakusu. And on the back of it, she wrote in French another version of what Shakyamuni said. Quelle merveille, tous les êtres ont la sagesse et la vertu du Tathagata. So, how wonderful. All beings have the wisdom and the virtue of the Tathagata. The Tathagata, that's a jargon word from Sanskrit meaning the awakened one. So, Genroshi wrote that on here. Very, so it was 20 years ago in August that she wrote. It was the 10th of August, 2003. She gave me this. And actually, I say when I started teaching, but I had started teaching 3 years before that, so I don't know what happened. But I was the first one to get one, so she took a while, I guess. And it was very astute, but she always is very astute when she's given me things like this and names and quotes and things. And I think I'm still trying to understand this quote. I'm still trying to understand this line that the Buddha said, supposedly said. And when working with someone on this koan, it's become more clear because it's become clear to me how the person isn't seeing it. So then it becomes more clear to me of ways of seeing it, of understanding this quote. So, we often hear it as, okay, so he woke up, he became enlightened, and saw that everybody else was enlightened. Or, no, what we usually think is he became enlightened, and so because he's one with everyone, everybody else became enlightened too. This is how we usually see that phrase. But when you hear it this way, that's not at all it. It's like everybody is already that. And suddenly he's awakening to, he's saying, oh yeah, everybody else is already like that. It's almost like he's coming late to the party or something. So it's what he awoke to was that everyone is already awakened. Something like that. Now, when I say Roshi was astute to give me this, it's because it turned, once again, like with my Dharma name, turns us away from ourself. So it turns me away from me, my awakening, and thinking that I'm different than everybody else, or that because I awaken, everybody else awakes, or, oh yeah, this is amazing. I am awakening and I'm seeing this. It turns us away from that. to see that it's already like that. So it's almost like the Buddha in that the story, Shakyamuni, is almost secondary. He's almost an accessory to the story. He's like the vehicle that helps us, that we are using to hear about this fact that everybody's already awakened. But it's not about him. It's actually, the whole myth came from that. And so the whole practice, the whole schools, everything, the tradition, the ism, all came from that. And we mistakenly think that it's about him, but it's not actually about him at all. It's about us. It's about everyone. So it's like he's the pictorial space, and all the birds in the world are flying freely there. I recently saw a cartoon somebody posted on the internet of like two birds sitting on a branch. One is big, so it's like the mother bird or the father bird, and one is the small one. And the big one is saying to the little one, "You're the universe disguised as a bird." Wow, that's amazing. What does that mean for us, you know? We already are the universe, but we're thinking we're a bird, or we're thinking we're a me. We're thinking that this form that we have is what we are and who we are. In fact, that's not. We are this manifestation, but the point is, what are we manifesting? What is our true nature? And so to become you know, like preoccupied with this and wanting to be young, wanting to be something else, wanting to have a different job, wanting to have a different house, wanting to becoming preoccupied with what other people are doing. Or how we want the world to be otherwise, we're focusing on what is unreal to a certain extent, to what is illusion. And missing the real truth or something, missing who we truly are. And so a day like this, where we come together and practice, is really a deep, deep, profound, it really has a deep meaning. It's not just let's come and sit together and, I mean, it is, let's sit together and have lunch together and connect online. It is that's true. But the real deep meaning of it is, you know, we are choosing to look into what is beyond the pictorial space of the wall. Bodhidharma famously is, as we know, sat. The legend is, the myth, sat for 9 years facing the wall. So was, you know, probably part of that time he was facing the pictorial wall. And yet, ultimately, what he was facing was the birds, all the birds of the universe fly freely there. Which is so vast and so profound that we can't possibly we can't grasp it. So then it's like a wall. It's like we feel like we're facing a wall. As we know, a lot of people in the Zen tradition literally do face the wall. Why not? On the other hand, why? We're always facing the wall, whether we're turned that way or this way. We're always facing the wall. And if I think back to, well, any artist, but you know, just because I recently saw De Staël, his work evolved, right? So impermanence. He also, you know, was at a time when art was changing, when the art world was changing, and. Well, because everything changes, everything's impermanent. But you look at his early paintings, and the colors are different, and the images are different. It's much more figurative, and then it evolves and it becomes more abstract. And then there's a lot of lines, just you know, black ink on white. And then his late paintings are just these, you know, thick paint in these, it's pictorial, it's figurative, but with just this gorgeous paint, this gorgeous substance on there. It's all valid. You know, we can judge it and say, oh, I like this better than that. We can have our preferences. But it's all an expression of this moment. His expression of this moment. And our experience when we are there looking at a painting is just this moment. It's like sitting on a cushion. It's just this moment. Just this. Whatever it is. So I don't have any idea what time it is. I don't see the time on this computer screen. Oh yeah, okay. All right, okay. So what time do
we? Yes,
12:15
yes,
starts.
I'm
So yeah, let's open it up and see if anyone has anything to say, comments, or. Questions?
This slogan thing, don't look for perfection, look for yourself, was 5, 6 years ago at least. And I really needed it at the time. There was a bus that had soyezvousmeme.com. But sometimes you think maybe somebody in there really knew what they were putting out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if they didn't really know, but they knew somehow.
So,
Yeah.
yeah.
What was it in advertising? What was it for?
I don't know. I'm so shocked by the sight of it. It was on buses for a while.
Well, and as we know, you know, the slogan for Nike, you know, shoes and sporting goods, it used to be, I don't know if it still is, just do it. can't
know how
believe
to
what.
I don't know how to raise my hand on this thing. And I don't
Yeah.
know who should, so if there is some way to raise your hand and we're supposed to raise our hand, let me know.
You don't need to raise your hand.
Hello?
If you want to talk, yeah, go ahead, Catherine.
First of all, lovely to be here with you all. And Amy, thank you for being so consistent over the few years I've been with you in your message of just being here. Because I think that's really what makes this so special. Now, I'm sitting here at home, and there's a book called Meditation in a New York Minute, which I read before I started sitting with you all, when I was more in the mindfulness mode. And it gave a formula, which was, if you're sitting and something is tracking in your head, the solution is just to take a pen and write something down and then go back to sitting. And I'm only saying that because I do think about it, and sometimes in the morning I do use this technique, knowing that that's not really what it's about, but it does work for me. And as I was, since I am sitting here and I have a pen, you said true freedom is wanting what you have. And I was wondering if that was true freedom, or is it freedom, or is it, I don't know if the word is happiness, is it plenitude? And then I was like, well, what is the difference? I don't even know what freedom is. Maybe that is freedom, but I wasn't completely comfortable with it because sometimes what you have, I mean, let's say, let's just take an example. In the apartheid sect, world, if you're, well, in social engagement situations, true freedom has to be trying to change the world. I mean, it can't be just being satisfied with an unsatisfactory situation. But I guess it's the duality. I mean, you can still be there and be sat, I mean, be satisfied because this is what it is. And again, I don't know if that's freedom.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. and good questions, the I guess maybe we could say you say there's a duality. Maybe we could say that of course there are different ways of talking too, so right, of course, someone who's in prison doesn't feel free, and they don't necessarily want that cell that they're sharing with three guys who one who has a TV on 24 hours a day, and maybe that's not what they want, right? So then we would m maybe we could talk about it more in a way of freedom within oneself. Or not attaching to things being a certain way or something that, there's this guy who I used to know. I'm sure I would still be a friend of his if I saw him, but he lives in the US, who Fleet Mall, who was a student of Bernie Glassman's, who was imprisoned for dealing coke for 25 years. And he was a big time dealer. And he had been a student of Buddhism all the time he was dealing cocaine. And he got caught because somebody down the, they caught somebody lower than him who told on him, and so then he was arrested. And he could have had his sentence reduced if he had, you know, told on the people above him. But he didn't want to do that. He wanted to take responsibility for his actions. And so he got a big, severe sentence of 25 years. And he said, until he was in prison, he never truly practiced. It was only when he was in prison that he really, really gave himself over to his practice. And he had to like go into a broom closet in order to practice, to have some time to sit, to meditate on his own, because in his cell with the TV on all the time and other cells with their TVs on all the time and guys screaming and doing stuff all the time, he had nowhere to practice. And so he really had to say, okay, if I want to do this, where am I going to do it? How am I going to do it? And he, because he had this cleaning duty, part of his job was to clean or something, he knew there was this broom closet, and he would close himself up in the closet and practice. And he was so he became devoted to his meditation practice in a way that he had never been before. And then he became grateful for that broom closet and for the possibility to awaken, to just be here now with his circumstances in a way he had never been before. And then that transformed in, he started working in the infirmary, in the infirmary with patients who were sick, with prisoners who were sick. It was during the AIDS crisis, and so he was working a lot with people who had AIDS, which then further helped him with his practice. And he became free within himself, even though he was still in prison. He was not even allowed out to go to his father's funeral. He had a small child when he started practice, and when he went to prison. When he came out, his son was 20 years old. And yet, this was his great awakening, was being in that prison cell. So, it's just more, it's a good question, what is freedom? Really good question. And you can use that as fuel to practice. You know, you began by saying, so yes, it's just showing, just being here, you know, just this consistency of just being here. Wherever we are, in my practice, in just my own personal practice, but then also my practice sharing it with others, and developing sangha and making it possible for others, there's been great freedom in wanting what we have. Just being with what we have, not having, I struggled a lot at the beginning of my teaching practice because I didn't have anything. I thought I didn't have anything. I didn't have any cushions, I didn't have any bells, I didn't have any students, I didn't have any place to practice, I didn't have, I thought I had nothing. But when I let go of that, I realized I had everything. We didn't need anything special. And then I could truly appreciate it, what it was, and it became really a lively, vigorous practice by letting go of wanting something else. I wanted exactly what I had. Of course, I don't have anything, so it becomes wanting nothing. But thank you for the question. Good question. And thank you too for your consistent being since we reconnected again in what, in 2016 or something like that?
Something like that.
It was what, right when we created the center and you had seen Norman Fisher. Yeah. You've been really steady too. You've been here too. As all of you have. who are present here. So thank you all.
I have a little bit trouble with seeing people as awakened. I mean, starting with me and looking at people being violent and can you say something to that, please?
Yeah, another good point. Because that's the other aspect of this founding myth is that, okay, everybody's awakened, but, or and, let's say and instead of but. So when we say but, that erases everything that comes before. So everyone is awakened, and many of us don't know it. We don't see it. And because we don't see it, that we behave in ways that are not wholesome, are not healthy, that do harm, that take us farther and farther away from our who we truly are, our awakened nature. So even if we don't see that everybody is awakened, we can just kind of say, okay, somebody said that, and somebody believes that, or somebody experienced that. What does that mean? And maybe we can start looking at ourselves and others differently and say, okay, so if I'm already awake, if my nature is awakened, what does that mean? So I can start looking at myself and trying to see who I truly am, instead of looking for my perfect being, look at who I am, look for my, who I am. And also see that in others then, look at others and say, okay, so instead of wanting them to be perfect or blaming them for behaving in a certain way that is violent and unhealthy for themselves, you know, another story recently that I've become aware of, someone who I went to high school with, a woman who I knew well when I was in high school, who was my age, obviously, and who our boyfriends were twins, and so we spent a lot of time together when we were in high school. Even if it was just for family gatherings or something, I recently discovered, once again through the internet, through social media, that this woman is a candidate in, there's a reality TV program in the US. Yes, it is kind of scary. There's a reality TV program in the US now that's called The Golden Bachelor.
Yes.
You've heard of this?
It's big time on Stephen Colbert right now.
Right. So, and it's, you know, there's this guy who's 70 years old, The Bachelor. It's golden. It used, normally the program, it's a reality TV program of a bachelor who's this hot young guy. And then there's, you know, 20 hot young ladies who want to be, they're candidates to be his date, you know, to be chosen. But now they've done one for the boomer generation, which is called The Golden Bachelor. So the guy's 70 years old, and the women are all over 60. There's 22 of them. And one of them is this woman who I went to high school with.
That's amazing.
And yeah, it's pretty weird. However, you know, it's not surprising at all when I know what I know this woman, or I knew her when we were between the ages of 15 and 18. And I saw her when I went to my high school reunion, you know, 5 years ago. And actually she came. I gave a Dharma talk at the Minnesota Zen Center, that when I went back from my high school reunion, the Minnesota Zen Center, through Norman Fisher, actually, they invited me to give a Dharma talk. And this woman, who is one of these candidates, she came. Only a few people from my high school class came. And she was one of them who came to hear my Dharma talk at the Minnesota Zen Center. So just, why do you, what made me think of that? Oh, that, I know there's something incredibly poignant about the fact that at this age, that we would still seek this kind of, of course, it's a desire for love and connection, how, but it's very poignant that it goes through all of this. It's taking place in this looking at the superficial and this cultivation of a person, an I, this whole, whole persona that's created in the pursuit of love. I know that that's what she's seeking. And she would not deny it. Of course, she would say that that's what, because I think they all have like little presentations that they give and stuff. I haven't really gone into it very deeply, but I saw some of what she's doing and it's like, wow. But I know it's all coming from this deep desire to be loved and to experience love and to share love. We can say it's going in like, so Christine's asking about people behaving violently. This is really becoming caught up in the superficial and in appearance and in how I want people to see me. So these 22 women want this guy to see them, but they also want the millions of, because it's a television reality show, they want millions of people to watch them and see them do this, right? There's something I find really poignant about that. Of course, there's always also something like tragic about it, but that's part of the poignancy of it. We can, and I'm sure Stephen Colbert is like making fun of the whole thing, right? I don't know what Stephen Colbert is
He did.
saying.
It was Jimmy Kimmel, and he did show a picture because his aunt went. She's kind of this dumpy little New York lady, and all these other babes are absolutely stunning. I mean, they're wearing nightgowns. And there's a picture actually from the show, I think.
So what do you mean? I haven't seen the other people. I only know I've seen the woman that from who I grew up with, but.
It looks pretty much like a competition of who can be the most glamorous and beautiful. I mean, it's not just come in your jeans and let's
No.
chat and everything. And they were knockouts, really. I didn't see the guy.
So, well, just yes, a little, just little, which is interesting too for what we're talking about. So, this woman who I know, apparently they all make this arrival, and it's like this, a key moment is they arrive and he's standing there waiting to see them. They arrive in cars. And so, my high school friend arrives. This she gets out of it's this old lady with a walker and a wig, like in a nightgown, right? She comes, she starts arriving like this, and so everyone's like, he's like really surprised, and he says to her, do you need some help? And so then she whips off the wig, throws the walker, rips off the nightgown, and says, do I look like I need help? It's really cheesy. But, if you think about it, it's all about appearance. It's really, so who are we, what are we presenting to the world, and then how does the world respond to us, So if we arrive as an old woman with a walker, someone responds to us in a certain way. If we arrive like this sexy lady, in this tiny little dress, someone responds to us in a different way. But underneath all of those appearances, who are we? So we use the appearances to attract attention. But ultimately, that's not who we are, right? So she's already saying, I'm not, this is not who I am. On another level, she's saying, this is who I am, right? I'm not this old lady with the wig and the walker, but this is who I am. But who is that really?
And somehow seeing that from that rises compassion also towards those that are aggressive or violent or whatever. Because if you see that the oneness, then you have love for them too. And this and all the suffering that comes for them from that place where they are at that moment, and not seeing it. Easy to say.
What?
Easy to say.
Well, and but we can see what you're saying because we know it for ourselves. You know, we know ourselves when we do something violent, or when we react with anger, or when we like are trying to like, you know, seduce people, or when we're like desperate to have someone see us in a certain way. We know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. So we can relate to, or we can understand, but we actually feel what the other is feeling. That's what compassion is, feeling what the other is feeling. Feeling this desire to be loved. You know, I know that's what she's doing. But, and even when we react violently, it's kind of a twisted love. It's kind of a twisted, well, we won't go into the twisted love aspect, but wanting things to be our way and not seeing that it's perfect as it is. We won't go into that perfect as it is either.
Amy, thanks again for your beautiful talk. Lately, I've been with some difficulties. I don't know what is going on with my throat. It's changing or something. But anyway, I would like to ask you now, you said, I want to be my way, and we know that causes a lot of trouble. But can't it be that sometimes to be my way is, let's say, synchronized or is an expression, a manifestation of who you really are, using your words. I mean, how can you distinguish between some kind of ego driving and the fact that sometimes you feel that your way is not your way? Does it make sense, the question?
What do you mean, like, by you feel that your way is not your way?
Because you are acting out of what you would say the true person within you. How do you distinguish? I mean, of course, I think it's part of the practice, but sometimes, at least with myself, I feel I'm acting not of my, maybe it's an illusion, but by now I can more or less distinguish when I'm ego acting or non-ego acting. And the non-ego acting is no longer something that you could say is you. But even then, it's you. So the question is, basically, how, in this deep way of practice, can we distinguish between to act according to some kind of deep understanding of who you are, and to act in the ego mode?
Mm-hmm.
sometimes these things are a little bit confusing. And I think part of the practice is that, is to distinguish between two these modes of acting.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. So yeah, like I always say, the real question is, who are you? And when you see who you truly are, then it becomes more clear when you are acting out of some idea of who you are, or who you want to be, or who you want people to think you are, or an image that you want to present or something. In terms of, you know, it's hard without a concrete example, but do you mean that you would be doing something for glory or fame, rather than because it's what needs to be done? I'm not sure.
Yeah, just perhaps an easy example, and just in a very normal way. I've been involved, and many of you as well, in the educational process. And when you are involved in this, you know that sometimes you just have to act not in a nice way, let's put it like that. So you are behaving according to certain values, to certain intuitions, whatever. And at that, I would say that you are synchronized then with something that has to do with the deep I within you, or the real I, as you said. Okay? But other times, maybe what happens is that although that behavior is determining you, what you want to do, sometimes it can happen that, in fact, you can be inflated by your own ego. So my question is really, in terms of practice, how do you really check these two different situations in which you are acting out of your own compassionate being, or this can be obscured by more your ego driving? I don't know if this is coming closing to the deep question I want to do, because the deep question is, okay, if we are practicing, we tend, of course, to learn with the practice, with the teachings and all that, and to act from that inner, deep, truthful, compassionate being. But sometimes you can be also acting, or many times you can also be acting not in that way, although you think you are.
Yeah, well, and maybe we can become caught up in that distinction. You know, like I think it's Suzuki who said, there are no enlightened beings, there's only enlightened action. And so it's more, rather than looking at, oh, am I acting from a place of attachment to self or not, you can see, well, what is it that I'm doing, you know? Yeah. In a circumstance, like you say, you might, in a classroom or something, you might have to behave in a certain way. I don't know what example you were talking about, but it's something we see with children a lot. So those of us who are parents, we know with children, we have to do things sometimes and say things that might be painful. That might be, you know, we have to set boundaries. We have to make rules. We can't, you know, give, even though we want them to not suffer, we can't give them endless amounts of money or We have to tell them to stop doing some behavior that they shouldn't be doing or something. We have to intervene sometimes. We're doing it for the good of the child. So we could say we're also, in our daily lives, are we acting from a place, from an intention of doing what's helpful, wholesome, or are we acting from a place of doing harm? Is what we're doing harmful? I also have a problem with my throat, but I'm recovering from a cold, so.
Or rigidity, you can become very rigid as well.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. That's a good sign. And when you find yourself becoming rigid, you can say, oh, okay, what am I holding on to here? Where am I stuck?
That is the question, you see. I mean, the difficulty is that sometimes it's out of habit or something like that. This rigidity is just a distortion of that more wholesome attitude you have to. If you take the example of education, of setting out boundaries and sometimes being tough, whatever. So, yeah, again, perhaps I'm as practicing Zen many times, you gave a good hand. I mean, what you said, you can see the effects of your actions instead of being all the time reasoning about this distinction. That's true. Maybe that's that's what I can pick up from your answer. That's the most interesting thing. But I can also question out of this, out of acting from this deep source can sometimes happen that shit happens.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then we atone for it. We try to be attentive and recognize it. I'm being told that we're out of time. So we'll have to stop now, and we will be back in 2 hours, or actually we'll try to keep back to real time. So we'll be back at 3 Paris time, 2 UK and Portuguese time. Like I said earlier, try to stay in the silence as much as you can in your home environments. We will stay in silence and share our meal together. And we'll be back for sitting, and possibly, if we have time, a circle at the end. Thank you.